1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can also be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110, but as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest today is Mr. Nick Taylor, author of American Made, The Enduring Legacy of the WPA, When FDR Put the Nation to Work. Welcome, Nick, back to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Richard, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you. Meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Mr. Nick Taylor has written 10 books of nonfiction, both solely in collaboration on a wide variety of subjects. His History of the Works Project Administration, American Made, The Enduring Legacy, the WPA, was published in 2008 to wide acclamation. His other subjects include books on tournament bass fishing, infiltrating German neo-Nazi underground in Hitler's shadow, the story of the laser, and work with astronaut and senator, former senator John Glenn on the best-selling book, John Glenn, A Memoir. He lives in New York City with his wife, Barbara Nevins Taylor, an investigative reporter for Fox 5 News. You know, H.W. Brand, the historian, has written in his book on FDR, Traitor to His Class, that Herbert Hoover hated Roosevelt during the campaign, and he hated him even more after the election. He never really understood what FDR's landslide victory meant. He even thought that the slight uptick in the economy right before the election was a sign that his patient policies had all but ended the Depression, only the economy to swoon again as a result of Roosevelt's victory, which frightened investors and made them withdraw from the marketplace. As Brand wrote, like many other counterfactual claims, Hoover couldn't be disproved. Hoover finally came to his senses decades later. Regarding his limitations on his perspective, Hoover said, "My education was that of an engineer, and I do not know all the nuances of economics." He also said in close to his death in 1964 that he had lived all the bastards. I know this is a family radio station, but I'll use that. Today, almost 80 years later, the Republicans and the Tea Party base are still at war with FDR and the New Deal. Nick, please guide our listeners with some of the history regarding this decades-old war.
Gladly, Richard. The fact of the matter is that the rhetoric and the policies are virtually unchanged since the 1930s. And a good way of looking at this is to recall what the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce did in response to the Social Security Act of 1935. The National Association of Manufacturers said that unemployment insurance will, and I quote, facilitate ultimate socialistic control of life and industry. Walter Lippmann, the columnist, called the Wagner Bill, which was a wage and hour bill named after the New York congressman, called the Wagner Bill Wages and Hours the most amazingly vicious and daring attack upon industry and the liberty of individual conduct in the history of American government. In U.S. News, described the National Association of Manufacturers campaign against the bill as the greatest ever conducted by industry regarding any congressional measure, and the National Association of Manufacturers again increased its dues in its budget, and in the 4 years after Roosevelt's inauguration, its income increased nearly sixfold. Now, what that means, basically, is that the war that we're seeing carried out in Congress today against things like Social Security by way of privatizing it, against continuing unemployment insurance, these kinds of things have been going on for all these years, and they're part of a concerted campaign against New Deal, those policies have endured for all this time, but that doesn't mean they have not been constantly under attack.
You know, recently, and to add to what you said, there was a UCLA study that concluded that FDR's policies not only did not end the Great Depression, but instead actually prolonged it. Two UCLA economists said they figured out why the Great Depression dragged on for almost 15 years, and they blamed a suspect previously thought to be on reproach, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. After scrutinizing Roosevelt's record for 4 years, Harold L. Cole and Lee E. Ohanian concluded in a new study that the New Deal policy signed into law almost 80 years ago, 78 years ago to be exact, thwarted economic recovery for seven long years. You know, first of all, the Depression's economic contraction ended after 43 months. That was about 2 or 3 months after FDR's inauguration. And the full recovery began in its 10th year. What drives these revisionist academics to invent statistics and to distort facts?
Well, revisionist economics applied to the New Deal have been very popular lately. Economists can cherry-pick statistics to make any case they want. The Council on Foreign Relations held a conference a couple of years ago where some economists said the Depression would have ended sooner if the government had done nothing. Of course, that ignored the fact that people were living in shantytowns and starving. Economics is a scientist, but it shouldn't be a bloodless one. The effects of economic policies on human beings, especially families, can't and shouldn't be ignored, and that's what these people are doing here. Economists and politicians ignore and distort facts that don't fit what they want to believe. And that's the case with these claims that FDR prolonged the Depression. He did, but only because he mistakenly tried to balance the budget and pulled money out of the economy by cutting the WPA by two-thirds, among other things. Withdrawing that stimulus in 1937 brought on a new recession, and that's what put off the recovery until World War II. Now,
and you know, it's interesting, and it's a very good point. He was really pushed by Dixiecrats, the Federal Reserve, the businesses to tighten up. And this is really an interesting point because we're seeing that today. You know, we understand Keynesian economics to a degree that we want to put money in circulation. When Roosevelt was pressured to do this, we had a sharp downturn. He primed the pump, and the recession, basically the 1938 recession, lasted only a few months.
Exactly. He primed the pump again after... Right. After withdrawing the stimulus. And, of course, that it is true that Social Security being taken out of workers' paychecks and out of employers making their contributions also withdrew money from the economy. But he also tried to balance the budget by, as I said, withdrawing or cutting the WPA budget by two-thirds. And really that's what prolonged the Depression.
Yeah, and it's an interesting fact because many people say, well, it was spending of the Second World War that ended the Depression. Well, what's the difference how you spend it? And in fact, when the bottom line is that nobody in Congress would have spent the monies that were required, $430 billion or so, to pay for World War II on domestic problems. So, in fact, their whole argument is distorted because money did bring us out of the Depression. And that's an interesting point. You know, the New Deal and FDR with his four freedoms stood emphatically for liberal democracy and set the standard for the rights of labor, economic opportunity for all, protection for the investor, and then set the stage for the civil rights, fair housing, women's rights, and the environmental movement. With all of that 20th century advancement, do Republicans want to roll the clock back and return to the pre-New Deal days of sweatshops, polluted air and water, and the back alley abortions?
Well, that will be, they won't admit it, of course, but that will be the effect of their more radical Tea Party influenced policies. They won't address the effects of those policies, only the ideology behind them. I mean, let's face it, Richard, the EPA, which is a Richard Nixon product, by the way, is under attack at both congressional and state levels, certainly by the Koch brothers with their massive and secretive contributions to the Tea Party. Rand Paul says he doesn't like being told to use toilets that conserve water.
How about toilet paper?
I don't know how he stands on toilet paper, but let's go ahead and eat up the forest as much as we can if we need more of that. you know, he and others have already gone after the minimum wage and rules that govern how many hours teenagers can work after school, for example, and what age they have to be. And this tells me that, as a matter of ideology, they really want to go back to the 19th century.
You think that with this attack on the minimum wage, and of course, do you think in the next few seconds that there'll be a lot of jobs here at $1 an hour?
I think there's probably, based on public reaction, a level at which the minimum wage can't go below. But again, we're talking about ideology. We're talking about a system or a party ideology, both on the part of regular Republicans and Tea Party-influenced Republicans, that says that really this is a country about the ability of corporations to make as much money as they can, and individuals to make as much money as they can, and not pay any of it into in taxes,
right,
which increase the general good.
We have to go to a break. Nick, we're coming up against a short financial news update. I want to remind our audience they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460, live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is Nick Taylor, author of American Made, The Story of the WPA, and we're talking about 80 years of Republican revisionism and their war against FDR and the New Deal. We'll be back in a moment or two to continue this dialogue.
Business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, in a speech this afternoon, President Obama will propose an overhaul of the country's tax code to help reduce the deficit. The White House is calling it a balanced approach to the problem. There are four key areas. The administration says it will keep domestic spending low, find ways to save money in defense spending and on Medicare, and also simplifying the tax code. Retail sales rising in March, marking a ninth consecutive month of gains. Gas prices boosting the overall increase to 0.4%. Analysts said the gains would have been better, but for the fact that Easter does not come until late April this year. And Toyota's production delays now spreading to Europe. The automaker will suspend production for 8 days because of parts shortages. The massive earthquake and tsunami last month causing major disruptions in Toyota's supply chain. It's already halting some North American production this month, and operations in Japan have been limited. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Ashley Webster.
Every president since 1968 has called for health care reform, and all we have to show for it today is a law that almost nobody likes. Which leads to an idea. Maybe Washington bureaucrats aren't the ones to fix health care after all. Maybe health care policy should be set by people who are more accountable to you than federal bureaucrats. Go to healthcarecompact.org and find out how you can help turn a Washington failure into an American success.
Call us crazy.
You're crazy.
But we believe radio should be delivered free of charge.
Are you crazy?
Go ahead. Listen all you want. It's free. WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD3.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, author, historian Nick Taylor, who has joined us before, and our subject is FDR perspective and 80 years of Republican revisionism and their war against his legacy. You know, the middle class was crushed in the Great Depression, which started with the stock market crash of 1929. Today, the middle class is under attack again and is not only shrinking, but struggling for existence. Nick, is this as a result of GOP economic policies of the past decade, or is our labor too expensive and Americans should expect less?
Well, labor does bear some of the blame for the high cost of making things in the United States, and especially for escalating pension costs. And these things have to be looked at. Unions have also seen their share of corruption and incompetence. But on the other hand, they brought millions of people into the middle class by gaining living wages for their members, and in the bargain, making those members into customers for the same goods that they produced. They improved the economy. But now, low-wage workers can only afford to buy goods made in China. Having said that, GOP economic policies consistently favor owners over workers. That's just their ideology. That's been a consistent theme of the policy direction since Reagan, and even earlier, back to those National Association of Manufacturers and Chamber of Commerce attacks on New Deal labor policies.
Now, would you say that people like Stanley Tool, who was listed in the New York Times, the CEO of Stanley Tool is listed in the New York Times publication, the top 200 corporations, made something like $25 million last year. And this is a company that had existed in Connecticut for close to 200 years almost, and decided to export its jobs overseas to increase its profit margins. What do you think about people exporting jobs out of the United States then crying poverty? What's the thoughts?
Well, my thought is that the Supreme Court has equated individuals with corporations in the Citizens United decision. I think that if corporations are to be compared with individuals or equated with individuals, then they ought to be held to the same kinds of patriotic and national obligations. I think that certainly corporations owe their stockholders. They're in business to make money, and they're in business to make money for their stockholders. But by the same token, they're also they owe their surrounding communities. They owe the nation. They owe the nation for the stability that the nation has created on their behalf, their ability to do business, to sell their products in the United States. And I think that really it's a duty of a corporation. If we're going to say that corporations are the same as individuals, then corporations have the same duty the rest of us have to stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right, and have corporate responsibility. You know, today the struggle has been focused at this period of time in Wisconsin and especially in the Wisconsin courts, specifically over tax cuts for corporations and the governor's fight to balance the budget on the backs of state workers. It's interesting they have a deficit because they cut taxes on corporations. And what was his first remark after the beginning of the year? Wisconsin is open for business and interested in raiding their neighbor Illinois' corporations. This is very interesting. Is this the American way? In other words, you create a deficit, you make it good for corporations to attract businesses, and you ruin another state. In other words, who best serves the middle class? Corporations' largesse or the bargaining table? Isn't this something part of our economic ethos, a bargaining table?
Well, did you say corporations' largesse? Do you mean the largesse of corporations?
No, the largesse towards corporations, yeah.
It's interesting that that states are basically cutting their tax revenues by competing for corporations and for corporate locations, manufacturing sites, and so forth. And certainly those things create jobs, which create tax revenues, not from the corporations, but from the people who work for those corporations. But it certainly can be overdone, seems to be overdone at least. Corporations, once again, are in business to make money, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the extent to which we've become a business-dominated country with a growing gap between the rich and poor is a prescription for disaster, as economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman have pointed out. The competition between states for manufacturing, one would think that there might be some sort of compact between the states that would perhaps preserve jobs in the states that have them and create new opportunities for other states, just not shift those opportunities from one state to another.
Isn't this like a national Ponzi scheme between the states? Here, Wisconsin cuts taxes on corporations, creates a deficit, therefore goes to state workers and says, let's have clawbacks and givebacks because we have a deficit, you're being paid too much, attracts companies from neighboring Illinois. Illinois, therefore, loses its industrial and tax base and has a greater a deficit. Isn't this just the shifting of corporate ownership and management from one state to the other and playing a kind of roulette wheel game with the workers?
Well, it seems to be the case. And, of course, everybody says, well, jobs are mobile today, but if you move
can't
a
sell your house.
Plant from Wisconsin to Illinois, it doesn't mean the people who have the jobs in Wisconsin are going to be able to move to Illinois. I don't think that that's a burden that should be placed on workers, moving with every job that moves to another state.
Especially when people can't sell their houses.
That's correct.
You know, in other periods of times, yes, there were jobs shifting to the south, there were jobs shifting to the west, we have population shifts, but now we have people locked in where it's not, forget the whether the house is underwater or the mortgage is a struggle to pay, but there's
well,
not the buyers around.
On workers generally. It's not only an attack on the jobs that, or the companies that create jobs by being lured away to other states, but there's an attack on wages, there's an attack on pension systems, there's certainly an attack on the collective bargaining rights of public workers in Wisconsin and in other states, including Ohio and Florida. It's an attack on workers, and this is one of the things that is attempting to reverse the policies of the New Deal when workers for the first time gained collective bargaining rights and certain certain matters having to do with the conditions under which they worked. I mean, I think the country has forgotten the conditions that workers endured before collective bargaining.
We're going to get to that after our next break. We have to break for a commercial. I want to remind our audience they're listening to WVOX 1460, live streaming on WVOX with my guest Nick Taylor, author of American Made, Story of WPA. We're talking about putting FDR in perspective and the 80-year Republican war against his legacy of liberal democracy. When we come back from the break, I'm going to ask Nick the following question. The Wagner Act of 1935 was called the Workers' Bill of Rights. This guaranteed collective bargaining to unions. Has the country forgotten its importance and that the unions built the middle class, which was the consumers in this country? We'll be back in a moment. Thanks.
And national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Ron Flatter. In a little more than an hour, President Obama tells us how he proposes to cut the federal deficit, reportedly proposing spending cuts of $4 trillion over the next 12 years. What's a White House source telling Fox News?
There will be four basic elements to this. That'll be cutting domestic spending, cutting some defense spending, which is a departure from the Republican plan, and then some very controversial items, changing Medicare and Medicaid to some extent to save money, and tax reform, which you can read as probably tax increases.
Fox's Steve Santani at the White House. Republican leaders just got a preview from the president.
The only concrete proposal in the president's plan that he'll roll out today is his plan to raise taxes. And I find that very unacceptable, given we're several days out from tax day in this country.
House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. The president speaks at George Washington University. This is a Fox News alert.
Here's a special message from Whitney Radio. The Broadcasters Foundation of America and Fordham University Press are making available a limited quantity of signed first edition copies of William O'Shaughnessy's brand new book, Vox Populi, The O'Shaughnessy Files. Only just now arriving in bookstores coast to coast for $35. Copies of the new Bill O'Shaughnessy book have arrived at WVOX and WVIP in Westchester. For every $35 donation to the Broadcasters Foundation of America, you'll receive a signed, personally inscribed first edition copy of Vox Populi, The O'Shaughnessy Files. Character profiles and heartwarming vignettes of legendary Westchester and New York figures. Jack Newfield, Bob Grant, Ossie Davis, Wellington Mara, Robert Merrill, John Spicer, Larry King, Ned Garrity, Dr. Rich Pisano, Mario Cuomo, Harry Belafonte, and beloved townies like Bill Scolin and John Branca. A dazzling and entertaining tour of Westchester and New York, past and present. You can now pick up signed copies of the brand new Bill O'Shaughnessy Westchester History Book here at our studios in New Rochelle. It makes a great gift for anyone who loves colorful characters and enjoys politics in New York and Westchester. A limited time offer for for just $35 to the Broadcasters Foundation of America. Signed copies are available now at WVOX and WVIP, One Broadcast Forum, New Rochelle. Call 914-636-1460 for directions. 636-1460. 636-1460.
Just over the Westchester line in downtown Greenwich, there's a spectacular new dining venue, Gabriel's Italian Restaurant. At number 35 Church Street, owner Danny Gabriel has created a warm, stylish restaurant with a great becoming wood-burning stone fireplace. A perfect setting for some of the best food Greenwich and nearby Westchester has ever seen. The hand-selected prime steaks, seasoned with sea salt and crushed peppercorns and seared to perfection, are the real deal at Gabriel's. Plus all your favorites. Thick-cut onion rings, cream spinach, and Chef Joseph Giordano's mind-blowing pasta creations. And best news of all for all diners in our area, the gracious Tony Capasso for years at Valbella is now heading up the dining room at Gabriel's. For reservations, directions, and a very special welcome from Gabriel's maitre d' Tony Capasso, call 203-622-4223. Gabriel's on Church Street in Greenwich. It's new and it's fabulous.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast Westchester County and the vicinity for this afternoon, cloudy with periods of drizzles and patchy fog. Highs will climb into the lower 50s. Light rain or drizzle possible to continue this evening. Overnight lows falling back into the lower 40s. On Thursday, we'll see the skies become partly sunny, highs into the lower 60s, mostly sunny, highs into the middle 50s on Friday. Increasing clouds, more rain developing late Saturday, continuing to Sunday, temperatures in the 50s both days. I'm Steve Pelletieri Jr., reporting for WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD.
Go global on WVOX.com. Call David O'Shaughnessy for more information. 914-636-1460.
1460 WVOX.
Back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates and my guest, Nick Taylor. Just a reminder to our audience, yesterday, April 12th, was the 66th anniversary of the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Warm Springs, Georgia. We're talking about his legacy and the ongoing non-stop revisionist war against the New Deal and his policies by the Republican right. You know, before the break, I asked this question, Nick. The Wagner Act of 1935 was called the Workers' Bill of Rights. This guaranteed collective bargaining to unions. Has the country forgotten its importance? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, as I started to say, the country has certainly forgotten the conditions that workers endured before collective bargaining and some of the other reforms of the early 20th century. I mean, we recently passed the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, where hundreds of women garment workers were killed because the fire exits were blocked off and they were locked in to keep them from getting away from the job. Before collective bargaining, not only wages, but health and safety were elusive. There was a liberty of contract, a theory that said, in effect, that an assembly line worker and Henry Ford were equal and had the liberty to draw up individual employment contracts. With the Citizens United decision equating corporate speech with individual speech, we aren't far, I don't believe, from returning to liberty of contract.
You know, we've seen great changes in the last 30 years since the administration of Ronald Reagan. His alliance with the former Dixiecrats of the South and the oil shocks of the 1970s. What has been the consequence of the Reagan tax cuts, the concentration in wealth in fewer hands, and the ascendancy of the super rich?
Well, millionaires pay half the taxes today that they paid in 1945, less than half the taxes that they paid in 1945. The Reagan tax cuts and actually the more recent Bush tax cuts have redistributed money into the hands of the rich at a rate not seen since the 1920s. We had a prosperous country under Bill Clinton in the 1990s when tax rates were slightly higher than they are today, and nobody complained about not getting rich enough.
That's for sure. We have one caller. Please state your name and keep germane to our subject, please.
It's Mr. Cam from New Rochelle, as always, and it's refreshing to hear a voice to the left. I think it's the first time I've heard it, but there we are. I have another theory here as to how we're being hoisted by our own petard and how we lost our industry. This chronic lowering of wages that has taken place, the class warfare waged by Republicans, the shifting of money upward, doesn't pay now to really invest in a robot or automation. If you can push labor harder, lower wages, break a union, that'll get you by for a while. What the Europeans and Japanese have done has have a lot of high-class robotics and automation. My understanding is their productivity is a good deal better than ours now. The Japanese can turn out a car with far fewer workers than we can, and the quality is better. Don't you think that this lowering of wages and the inferiority now of our automation and mechanics has led to the deindustrialization of America due to our own greed?
Thank you for the call. What do you think, Nick?
Well, I think that that certainly has a lot to do with it. I don't know much about the automobile or other assembly lines in Japan or Germany, for that matter, where we get the rest of our cars. But I certainly think that in terms of the discussion we've been having, there has been an assault on workers to the extent that it's natural in some ways to want to lower manufacturing costs to make goods affordable. On the other hand, we shouldn't be in a posture of simply reducing the number of consumers because we want to save money at the cost of making the things that they would consume.
You know, it's interesting in reaction to taxes, and the president will be speaking at 1:30 today on his program to deal with the deficit. You know, during the Eisenhower period, which a lot of people, for better or for worse, reflect, irrespective of how they judge Eisenhower as the president, the economy did decently well, and we had a tax bracket of over 91% on people earning $220,000 in those days, which would probably be equivalent to $2 million to $4 million today. So, you know, and again, as you brought up in regards to the Clinton administration, the taxes had been raised from the deficit creating a low tax bracket of Ronald Reagan at 28% and George W. Bush, the first. And what happened from those huge deficits? Clinton was able to raise revenues. The stock market practically tripled and unemployment descended to nothing, and we created 22 million jobs. So the idea of this idea that redistribution of income is a terrible thing is not terribly accurate when you deal with the facts, you know?
No, exactly right. I'm a great fan of Jon Stewart and The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Last night he had a chart that showed what had happened if the Bush tax cuts had been allowed to expire. The great, the huge rise in the deficit flattened right out if those Bush tax cuts had been allowed to expire on schedule at the end of last year. Or if they hadn't been adopted in the first place, we wouldn't be having this discussion about cutting spending and so-called entitlements, because that's what ballooned the deficit.
And not only that, not only tax cuts, but two unpaid wars that have been going on. And, you know, it could easily be said by our, you know, Republican fiction writers inside and outside of Congress that, well, Obama could end it. Well, it's not easy to end a war once you've put blood and treasure into a battlefield for years and years. What do you then suddenly pull out tomorrow? And then the critics will say, well, what have you done? It's going to collapse. It's a horrible thing.
Well, Bush 43, George W. Bush, was the first president in U.S. history to wage war without increasing taxes. Presidents from George Washington on down have said we shouldn't pass. It's immoral to pass the cost of necessary wars on to future generations. That, of course, begs the argument whether this was a necessary war or not. But so it's hard to say what was the greater crime, the war itself or refusing to fund it from current revenues, and in fact hiding its costs by keeping them off the books.
No question about it. You know, getting back to domestic problems, you have written authoritatively about the WPA, which was the heart of the New Deal. During that period, the New Deal with other programs like the PWA, CCC, rebuilt our infrastructure with roads, bridges, parks, stadium, airports, schools, hydroelectric programs. What has happened to the infrastructure today, and can the market-oriented and small-government Republican Party keep up with the needs?
I don't think so. We need a modern infrastructure. The fact is that it's good for business, and I think that the Obama administration has failed to make a strong enough argument on behalf of infrastructure investments. These aren't just, it's not just spending, it's an investment. Reliable rail transportation, widespread broadband access, a reliable electric grid that doesn't cause blackouts when a thunderstorm hits, good roads and bridges. These aren't wasted spending, as the GOP claims. These are investments. These make it possible for people to do business, and they attract business to this country because this is a stable economy. It's a stable environment in which to do business, and nobody talks about that when they talk about this kind of spending, and I think they should. I think that infrastructure investments have not been sold nearly strenuously enough by the current administration. Admittedly, Obama faced a much larger deficit situation than FDR did when he was proposing programs like the Public Works Administration and the Works Progress Administration, the kinds of programs that brought the American infrastructure from the 19th into the 20th century. And today we need to bring the American infrastructure from the 20th century into the 21st century and be prepared for the future. That's what this will do. And that's the argument that has to be made.
Yeah, we're coming up against a break, but I want to just remind our audience that I was on the Taconic Parkway yesterday. It was built between 1925 and 1963 through the initiative of FDR. And I can tell you it was a wonderful road. And if you looked at the condition of it today, you wouldn't want to drive on it. Your tires would and shocks would go pretty quickly on a constant basis. We have to break for a commercial, and I want to remind our audience they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming WVOX.com. My guest is Nick Taylor, the author, and we're talking about FDR's legacy and Republican revisionism. Be back in a moment.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. The commander-in-chief has a plan to battle the nation's deficit. President Obama laying out details in a speech shortly. The GOP, though, warning him to expect a fight on one anticipated aspect of the plan, raising taxes on wealthier Americans.
One area that we know we're not going to get very far on is the idea that we're going to raise taxes on the very people that we expect to invest in our economy and to help create jobs.
House Speaker John Boehner, as for the White House view.
This speech is the president's answer to the House GOP 2012 budget. The White House promising a more balanced approach, one with more cuts to the defense budget, a different way to wring savings out of Medicare and Medicaid, and increases in taxes.
Fox Radio's Mike Makowitz and the Pentagon revealing for the first time that U.S. fighter jets have continued to strike Libyan air defenses after turning the mission over to NATO. Also that the jets are assigned to NATO and operating under its command. Fox News. We report, you decide.
I'm not comfortable with this. I think Jason should go to college now. I don't want him putting this off. He's already talked to a recruiter. Could you just talk some sense into him?
I understand, but I think if you just listen to him, you'll see. His decision makes a whole lot of sense. He wants to go to college right now, but he also wants to serve. That's why he's been talking to a National Guard recruiter.
The National Guard gives young men and women the unique opportunity to serve their country and communities part-time while they attend college.
You know, we've also got to figure out how we're going to pay for all this. The way things are these days, tuition, room and board, they're through the roof. And with our finances...
Honey, don't worry. He's worked that out with the Guard recruiter, too.
Plus, with the National Guard scholarship and other financial benefits, college students can graduate debt-free. Get to know what serving in the National Guard can do for your son or daughter. Visit NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the New York National Guard. Aired by the New York State Broadcasters Association and this station.
Spring is in the air.
It's my favorite time of year.
And your favorite station is keeping it fun.
Just fun to listen to.
WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, Nick Taylor, author, historian, talked a great deal about the importance of the WPA in his wonderful book, American Made, how the WPA brought people back to work in the millions, helped recreate and rebuild our infrastructure. Nick, you've analyzed the New Deal in depth and the leadership of FDR. How important was the GI Bill in building the middle class?
Oh, the GI Bill did more to build the modern middle class than practically anything, short of collective bargaining, or maybe even more than collective bargaining, because it took the people who had served in the American military, who'd offered their, in many cases, their lives, but of course they couldn't participate in the GI Bill, but it repaid the service to our country by making college accessible to people who had served and might not have had, under any other circumstances, an opportunity to go to college to improve their educations and therefore to improve their access to prosperity in the United States. It really was a great effort to assure that more people shared in American prosperity, and it did a great job at doing that.
Mm. You know, it's interesting that we have a small private army today, supplemented by the National Guard and the Reserves, and we have a lot of kids on the street, a lot of unemployed, the rise in gangs. Maybe if we had a more universal democratic army through a draft, we could lower the cost of the army, get these kids to be trained, and get them into a GI Bill kind of thing in their post-service experience. What do you think?
Well, with the draft, we wouldn't be fighting the wars that we fought, or we certainly wouldn't have been fighting the Iraq War, or it would have been over long before it was, because that was, as you'll recall, quite a controversial war. It was waged for reasons that proved not to exist, and the middle class, when its children are being drafted and put into service, as was the case during the Vietnam War, are going to rise up against wars of questionable reason. And so that wouldn't have happened, but certainly a broader, I don't think we treat our veterans very well. Mm. I don't, certainly the veterans of volunteer army, but I assume that one of the benefits is that they can go to college, and the reason that many of them join the service in the first place is to provide themselves with opportunity.
Mm.
A draft that spread that around would, of course, affect both rich kids and poor kids, and the rich kids would go to college anyway, and the poor kids would have the opportunity that I do believe they have under today's military.
Yeah, it's interesting because the military did a great deal to mature, educate, and enable millions of men, even in the periods of time when we didn't have wars, to become meaningful people in our society. You know, with respect of this and this fact that we don't have the kind of outlet in manufacturing, we don't have the training in the military, we've exported so many jobs, are we threatened by an economic society made up basically of rich and poor?
Well, yes, we are. I mean, our the growing gap between the rich and poor, I mean, it's a greater gap than it's been since the 1920s. If you look at the CEO compensation, executive compensation, at one point it was, 30 times what?
Yeah, 2000, what? it was 35 times. In 1970, it was 35 to 1. In 2000, it went to 1,000 to 1.
And that's 2,000. It's got to be greater than that today.
No, no, they did shrink it, and it's probably between 300 and 400, 500 to one. There was such a hue and cry on it over it, and it's interesting because, as I said, the New York Times just published the top 200 companies, and the CEOs averaged almost $12 million in compensation, and a lot of that is not taxed at the high bracket.
Well, it's I think that the as Joseph Stiglitz pointed out, is there's an article in the current Vanity Fair that speaks to the dangers of having so much wealth concentrated among the very top 1% or the 1% of the 1% at the top of the income brackets. I mean, what I wonder is if the super rich in our country want to live as the super rich do in the third world. I mean, there's a society where vast numbers of poor people are living among in a society where there are just a handful of rich people, and those rich people have to live in guarded, walled compounds, right. And the walls of those compounds are topped with shards of broken glass and armed guards patrolling at the gate, and these people drive around in armored limousines afraid of being kidnapped for ransom. I mean, we're just simply a better country where everyone shares in our prosperity, not just a few. And the people that participate or are part of that better country are the rich as well, if they're not that much richer than the rest of the population.
Well, you know, Professor Ray Madoff of Boston College on this program, in her book, Unending Power of the Debt, basically talked about dynasty and generation skipping trust. In other words, locking up these monies in a lockbox. They're not taxed initially. They may be never taxed to generations down the line. And this is creating almost a royal class in this country. And it is, and the people who serve these people, the upper middle class, in a sense, are driving the prices and driving the inflation of services without raising the cost of labor. It's a very interesting situation, and it could be a very dangerous situation for our democracy. You know, in our final moments, we're witnessing the struggle over the budget and the Republicans' idea that the size of government can be reduced, must be reduced. We've already gone through this kabuki dance over a few hundred million in a trillion-plus dollar budget, and more to come, because now we're going to deal with the 2012. This is just the 2011 budget. Is the myth around Reagan that government is our enemy? Did this create a new class of know-nothing members of Congress? What do you think about that?
Well, government's like anything else, Richard. It's, like Wall Street, for example. If you take it to excess and it's unrestrained, it can get out of control. But I think most of the people who work for the government at a federal and state and local levels are well-intentioned, and they're competent, and I think they believe in what they do, and they want to make things better. Attacks on bureaucrats, of course, are very, very easy, but these are attacks on cliches that often have nothing to do with reality. And I think that I think to a greater extent than the Democratic members of Congress, the Republican members really are ideologically driven and not practically driven.
You know, it's interesting, just a reminder to audience, Ronald Reagan cut taxes 70% on the rich to 28%. As a result of that, remember that, the deficit tripled. Just mind you, the deficit tripled, and in Ronald Reagan's 8 years in office, unemployment averaged close to 8%. And it's interesting that we, to a degree, suffered through the 12 years of Reagan and Bush 1 with deficits, and it took a tax increase of only 4% on the top brackets and selective increases on capital gains to literally bring a balanced budget. And what was the result of that 8 years of that action? 22 million jobs were created. Nick, do you have any closing thoughts regarding where we're going? And are we guilty of forgetting history? In other words, are we in a brain drain here? What's our problem?
Well, the first problem is that we didn't believe George H.W. Bush won during his primary campaign against Ronald Reagan when he said two words that were never truer, voodoo economics. We're always guilty of forgetting history. We always do so at our peril. There have been bubbles of this, and there was a tulip bubble back in Holland back in the 17th, 16th century. We seem to have to learn the same lessons over and over again as ideology and cherry-picked arguments steer us down the same old paths. If we learned and absorbed the lessons of history, we'd make a lot fewer mistakes, but that's not human nature. And I guess that what we're at war with is our own human nature.
Well, you know, it's interesting, as you reflect that human beings are human beings. We have in this country the good, bad, and ugly as any other place. There is no doubt that opportunity in the growth of this country has been a marvelous benefit, but it's been at a price. You know, it's been a price in terms of the environment, the frontier. We fought a civil war that involved literally almost more deaths percentage than almost any country in the world. It's a very devastating civil war over our values. Are we going back towards, in the final few seconds, are we going back towards a kind of civil war between of demographics between the old Americans and the new Americans? Is this coming on?
Well, I don't think that we're in a different war than we've ever been in. I mean, there's always been this ideological clash between free market absolutists and people who believe that there is a place for balance and for competent government to be applied in situations where the free market and capitalism doesn't get us everything we need to get for the majority of our citizens. We have to find balance.
Thank you. Nick, we've got a little level one alert today, but I want to thank you very much. You were great as usual. Thanks for coming on The Advocates. We're going to hear from you later in the year, I hope, on some of your new projects. And thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Richard. My pleasure.
Next week, I'll be discussing with Professor Carol Burkin her book, Civil War Wives, The Emerging Role of Women in America on the Onset of the 150th Anniversary of the Civil War. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information my guests will be posted. Have a great day and a great weekend. Thank you. Be well.